Brenton, will you give me the sign up sheet?
Are you going on?
Oh, my God, we, I feel like so bad, I have to get paid spring cleaning. Small seven up, small seven. Having the page bring it up from the basement there, I mean, from the, Senate Lawrence, but that's it.
Will you state your name for the record, please?
I will, Madam Chairman. Senators, I am Bruce Brunton, Assistant to the Regional Director, Health Education and Welfare in Seattle, and with me is Dick Ekstrom, who's the District Office Manager of Social Security Administration here in Salem. We are asking the committee to consider Senate Bill 757 to correct some administrative problems which were created by passage of Oregon legislation in 1969, which became effective July 1 of 1970. And I refer specifically to Oregon Revised Statutes 117.015 and 126.146. The former statute refers to administration of estates of absentee persons, and the latter deals with the establishment of guardianships. Both of these statutes provide that notice of hearing on a petition for administration of the estate of an absentee, or in the case of guardianships, a citation to appear on the hearing of petition for guardianship, be provided by various means: registered mail to the last known address of the individual involved, by publication, and that of course is an optional method in the case of an estate of missing absentee persons, a personal service in the case of guardianship, and then finally, to assure the absentee has notice, there is also a requirement that notice of hearing or citation be by prepaid postage letter forwarded through the Social Security Administration to the last known address available to that agency. We're asking that this latter requirement be removed from Oregon law. The rationale or problems that this has created are as follows. First, Social Security Administration's function, as we see it, primarily is to make a timely and accurate payment of benefits to Social Security beneficiaries. And to give you an idea of the workload they presently operate under, they, on a monthly basis, send checks to 28.8 million people in the United States every month. Under Medicare, they make 7 million, they review 7 million claims every year. And under Section B of Medicare, which is the doctor or medical coverage, 500 million claims are paid every year. And in addition to that, as you know, under federalization of aged, blind, and disabled programs, there will be 3.2 million people nationally transferred over to Social Security roles from existing welfare programs, and an additional 3 million people will be brought in as newly eligible. So you can see that the workload is substantial. We're concerned, in addition to possible embarrassment or violation of some confidence, if Social Security Administration sends notice through past employers to one of these individuals. We're concerned that third parties may open the mail and may create some problems in that regard. And there is, in addition to that, Madam Chairman, the inconvenience to employers. One of the primary concerns we have also is that missing persons may be, in many cases, only itinerants, and that the employer report records, which Social Security Administration has, are submitted 6 to 9 months after employment may have ceased, and consequently the notice is not necessarily an effective tool of giving notice to missing persons. And finally, the Social Security Administration does not maintain current addresses for Social Security cardholders unless they're on the beneficiary rolls. In fact, our belief is that the state of Oregon, for example, the records here in this state in most instances would reveal a more current address for individuals than Social Security Administration would have. That is a short summary of the concerns we have about the bill and the basis on which we'd like to have serious consideration of this legislation by this committee.
Questions of Mr. Broughton? Senator Ira?
Well, I'm sorry, I missed the... Did you say you were from Seattle?
Yes, the regional office in Seattle.
And this gentleman's from Salem?
Yes, he is the district office manager of the Social Security Administration in Salem.
I guess the question, and you came down here to testify on this?
Yes, in part.
I guess my thought really is, why was it necessary for you to come from Seattle? Why didn't the man from Salem do it and save some money.
Actually, I was here on other business as well.
I suspect.
We're presently administering, we have funded, as you probably know, a special committee on aging. And part of my duties is to monitor the operations of progress of that committee.
Is that how you got the sponsor for your bill?
I don't know if that's necessarily connected. I did write to Senator Roberts and also ask the Oregon State Bar for their consideration. I have checked with the Oregon Bar, and apparently they have not taken a position one way or the other on legislation. I think as a practicing attorney, you can appreciate that if a method of giving notices has a good possibility of not being an effective means of giving notice, it, on the part of an attorney, is a time-consuming item and runs costs up for clients, something that may well be set aside, particularly considering there are other time-tested methods, such as registered mail and personal service.
Further questions, Mr. Brown?
Did he have written testimony?
No. Senator Hoyt?
Well, I can understand why you don't want to do it, but you are doing it, aren't you?
Dick, can you address that?
Well, we will in certain situations where there is a reason, humanitarian reason, we will forward a letter to the last known employer. But the problem is the delays. The employer makes his report to the Internal Revenue Service. They extract their information. Then the records are turned over to Social Security. By the time we get the information posted, there's about a 9-month delay. And all we can do is forward a letter to that individual in care of the last known employer.
Well, that sounds awful serious. I'm not an expert in this matter, but as I understand it, the service you perform is called upon when someone is got lost, if you want to put it that way. In other words, nobody's heard from them for several years, and no other agency or no other source of information, unless it be the FBI, would ever hear that, know about that person. They've been arrested. You're the only other central agency.
Well, if the individual was currently receiving benefits, we would know the current address. If the individual was not receiving benefits, the only information we would have is if he works and uses that particular number to record, give to his employer, and the earnings are recorded under that.
Yes, I understand that. Now, you also have that person's home address, do you not?
No, we don't.
You don't?
The only address we have for an individual is at the time he makes application for the Social Security.
And that's not changed until he's 65 or until he tries to retire, and then you have a new address.
And these may be as early as 1935, 1936. Mm-hmm. Just think when you got your own Social Security number at one time. That's the address we have in our file.
Well, is there any other way? Gentleman spoke about using the other publication methods, and of course those are used, but they're really not very effective. If you've exhausted all the possibilities of the contacts in the area where the person, where the state's involved, is there any other way to find out if that guy moved to some friends in Alabama or something like that? It seems to me that this is a service that may overload your computer once in a while, but I don't see any other substitute for this kind of a service.
Well, I think the concern of the Commissioner of Social Security in this area is that he doesn't believe it is an effective procedure. And I think a couple of instances where it has been tried, it is found that the state or else the attorney or the court had later information regarding the individual's address than what was shown in the file for Social Security.
Okay, Madam Chairman, does anybody have any idea how many times your agency has been requested for this information in the last 24 months?
No, I don't. I'm sure that we have records of this in our...
I just have to pull whether it's effective or not. If it's not effective, then we'll be using it.
I think this correspondence that I've seen from Commissioner Ball, I think to Senator Wyatt, I think cited two instances where the procedure had been used in Oregon in the past 12 months.
Just two, huh?
Yeah, I think in both cases, they were not able to give a later address.
See. Would this be the best information you would get to answer my question would be the reply you are aware of that went to Representative Wyatt?
Yes, because it did come from the Commissioner's office in Baltimore, and I'm sure that he had access to the latest information.
Did Did Congressman Wyatt make the same kind of a question, ask the same kind of question that I'm asking?
I'm not sure.
No, not to my knowledge.
What kind of question did he ask?
Well, he just merely wanted to check out on behalf of an attorney in Portland why Social Security Administration didn't feel that they could fully carry this out. And hence the correspondence went back essentially in tune with what we're telling you here today. Now, I might point out that the attorney in Portland, I believe, was involved in drafting legislation. This was part of the Probate Reform Act that was passed, as I understand it, in 69 here in the state. And the attorney who requested Congressman Wyatt some assistance in implementing this was one of the members of the committee that drafted that legislation. I also understand that this is not widely used in the state of Oregon, and someone has indicated in correspondence that I have that probably only 10 or 12 times would this come up in the state, but I don't have figures to substantiate that.
10 or 12 times in the history of your department?
No, in probably 10 or 12 times per year in the state of Oregon. But, you know, we'd have to go to the county records to know, and our own records to know how many times. I don't know whether we keep specific records of numbers of notices we forwarded.
For the question. Thank you. Senate Bill 677. James Mattis.
Thank you, Chairman, or Chair, I'm not sure of my terminology. I'm Jim Mattis, and I'm the research attorney with the Bureau of Governmental Research and Service in Eugene. So I'm really representing the League of Oregon Cities, to speak and urge your affirmative consideration of Senate Bill 677. A special group of municipal judges and a city attorney and a city manager appointed, and they made a recommendation to the League of Oregon Cities Legislative Committee, which read in substantially the same terms as Senate Bill 677 as set forth for you today. The city's interest in 677 is that it would provide a mechanism, a means, which is not in the present statutes now, for a district court to assume the role of a municipal court. We have communities and cities in the state, and Senator Cook is the city attorney of Troutdale, I believe, which is one of the communities, that have in the past tried to utilize the district court under a very narrow statutory authorization as a district, as their municipal court. And we have other communities in the state that would be of an interest too. The special committee of the League would also suggest to you that we have had this legislature, although this legislative session has not had a bill before it suggesting a unification of the court systems this year. We have had it previous years, and I'm sure that type of suggestion will be before this legislature again in the future. This type of authorization under Senate Bill 677 would allow some experience to be gained whereby the state system is performing the role and function of a municipal court. And I think some of the data that might be gained from that could be very useful. I only have one small technical suggestion, and I'm not sure it's all that well taken, but your legislative assistant might take a look to see if under on line 8, where it talks about an agreement may be made pursuant to ORS 190.010, it may be that you'd like to expand that to include pursuant to ORS 190.003 to 190.110. 110 is another intergovernmental corporation agreement statute, which some people contend may be a little broader than 0010, so that's the only reason I told that. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions of Mr. Mattis? Senator White.
I had a bill just like this in a time or two, and it had some other provisions. I don't quite understand the need for this bill today, because there are some areas that are... what you want to do here, for instance, is to give Troutdale a court without having to have their own judge. Isn't that correct?
It does have that. It also has the provision to allow the district attorney to prosecute municipal offenses also.
Instead of a city attorney.
That's right. If there's an agreement.
Yeah, I see. Well, now, do we have authority for such agreements today?
No, we do not.
But what is the arrangement between Yamhill County and Amity?
Well, to my knowledge...
Judge Francis went down there and conducted their municipal court for them. Amity is an incorporated city.
I'm not aware of that type of thing unless... there would not be anything that I know of that would preclude, possibly under that city's charter, from appointing Judge Francis as a municipal judge. Now, maybe there was some arrangement of that nature done.
Well, I think that's right, and they contracted with Yamhill County for the services of Mr. Judge Francis. He had worked on company time.
We have there was provisions in the... there is provisions in the statutes which allows that type of operation in Multnomah County, and you will notice that the bill deletes that reference. That's up here on lines 21 through 29. But that only relates to Multnomah County. Now, I'm not familiar with what is occurring in Yamhill. But I don't think you have this type of authorization except for Multnomah County, and it's more limited than that.
But just one further question, Madam Chairman. Now, the new language, it sounds like that they can move into any town and do their work. It doesn't say anything about a contract there, does it?
No.
It's concurrent jurisdiction.
That is correct. Now, one of the reasons it's drafted that way was that... even under subsection 4 of the present ORS 46010, a district court found a contractual type relationship unconstitutional
Multnomah
County. That issue wouldn't have to be raised if the legislature were to give concurrent jurisdiction to the district court. But you see, Senator, this would not be operative unless the city were desirous of taking that.
I'm sure that would be the case.
Senator Smith.
How are fines, fees, and other monies coming to the municipal court now distributed? In the same manner as you have fees?
No. If the municipal court is the forum and the, let's say, traffic, for example, and the officer, we're a city officer, it all goes to municipal court.
There's provision in the statute someplace where
about
50%.
Split up the fees that are going to be in the district court, which would have ordinarily been in the municipal court, in this manner.
Well, I
district
didn't.
Court judges are paid by the state.
That's right, but under Section 3, you're providing for the district attorney to do the prosecution. And I presume the drafters of this was partial recompense for his carrying the city attorney's ball.
Oh.
Question? Senator
Hart,
did you have any
questions? Well, I didn't notice those last days. Since the repetition is here that I mentioned to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I wrote that, Matthew. You probably can't
Is it Mr. Ash?
Ash Manskis.
Ash Manskis. And please, the committee. I'm Don Ash Manskis, the city attorney for Beaverton. And I serve on the League of Oregon Cities Legislative Committee. Appear today on behalf of the city of Beaverton. I support the bill as it is. I also support the suggested amendment by Mr. Mattis. I choose to prefer that that would make it more effective in the future as far as additional contractual arrangements. Perhaps I may respond to one or two of the questions that were raised. In the Yamhill Amity situation, as I understand it, the court situation emanated because of a city-county sheriff enhancement contract. And it was from that type of arrangement that they had to think about what to do with the court. This is a supposition on my part. And whether it's legal or not, in view of Judge Beer's decision invalidating the Troutdale district court arrangement in Multnomah County, without getting to that, it may be that they're simply doing something to accommodate the sheriff's contract with the city. Similar things have happened in the past. For example, the citation rule of custody. Many cities did that before the legislature acted to authorize the issuance of citations. That practice was in force, and it sort of gave a legislative sanction as well as the iron fist and the velvet glove effects. The split on the fine money, I think, is a recognition not only that the district attorney may in fact by contract do some of the city attorney's work, but it's also, I think, the traditional way that traffic offenses revenue divided up. If a major traffic offense is cited into a district court by a city policeman, this is the arrangement too. The only other comment is that I became aware of the problem, incidentally, through Senator Cook way back when, I think it must be 4 years ago, when the situation arose in Troutdale. And I know the local bar committee, the local government committee of the bar sent a letter down at the very matter of 1970. So it's something I'm concerned with. And the city of Beaverton, incidentally, is supportive of the legislation because in the future we may, in fact, use this type of arrangement. The Justice Court has disappeared from Beaverton. We still have it in Tigard. Of course, we have the two municipal courts, one at Tiger and one at Beaverton, and two district judges now out in Hillsborough. As the workload increases on the city attorney's office, as well as the number of arrests and the type of crimes and some of the other jurisdictional problems we have, we may in fact look to this type of arrangement, some sort of accommodation to eventually may lead to the withering away of the municipal courts.
Thank you, Mr.
Well, I have a question, Madam Chairman.
Senator John.
The question that I have relates to fiscal impact. I don't see any budget analysis here. And, of course, we passed this language in contemplation of the district circuit or municipal court merger in Multnomah County in 71, but we defeated similar legislation in previous sessions, as Senator Carson will recall. Largely because there's a significant funding impact on the state general fund concerning the funding of district courts. And I am not one to hold any grief whatsoever for all the screwy city ordinances that we have, and I'd like to do away with city ordinance violations and go to a straight state court system across the board. But if we're going to give the district courts jurisdiction for handling city ordinance violations, and the cities get wise to it, they're going to do away with their own municipal court operations, and it's going to be a great amount of pressure on the legislature to create more district court judges. And because it does have cost ramifications, I think a lot of members here are going to want to know what the dollar amount is before they'd be disposed to vote affirmatively on this.
May I respond?
Yes.
Maybe three comments. One, of course, is I don't know the fiscal impact. Two, as a practical matter, cities, for example, Beaverton, I'll try to give you a concrete example. Tomorrow, the city of Beaverton, which incidentally is criminal ordinance, is drafted almost word for word, those particular portions of the state criminal code to be adopted immediately after. We did leave out things like the some portions of the loitering thing, which the city attorney thought was unconstitutional. And I think we can respond as far as city ordinance. There's some in the law, no question about it, but I think we're in a better position, for example, to respond to a constitutional question by the court and rephrase and redraft the ordinances to meet that. Second, as a practical matter, the city council could tomorrow, for example, repeal the theft provisions of the ordinance, and 150 shoplifters would immediately go over to the district court, prosecuted by the district attorney, transported 10 miles by the sheriff, and, you know, we would get out of the business of theft. We could, in fact, do the same thing on, I'm thinking in terms of the criminal now, the assault and the disorderly conduct and the typical things that we deal with, the minor type things. Also, we could transfer over 150 DUIL arrests last year, you know, right over to the district court now, and the city attorney would be free to do some planning in Sodom and Gomorrah, I guess. We, as a practical matter, we could dump things on the, we wouldn't dream of doing something like that, you know, latter, but we could do that now. As far as the city's getting out of the business, just because revenue works both ways. I don't like to inject the question of revenue.
Oh, please don't. That's the best argument in the world for doing away with municipal courts.
That's right. But it's not a question of revenue per se as to why, say, for example, the city of Beaverton may desire a municipal court. It is a city, and it has city ordinances, and it has a city court to enforce it. That may sound very simplistic, but basically that's the philosophical feeling of the city. And we, of course, now, on the DUIL, then went over and get one half the fine revenue. My time and the municipal judge's time, of course, would be saved. And we would, in fact, save the $9 a day we spend on 6 months in jail. So, you know, as far as making money or losing money, that would take some time. But I think my reason for supporting it is not, in fact, to dump things on the county.
Well, I understand,
you know,
that, and I think there's
a lot of... It gives us some alternatives to work with on a contractual basis.
I think that's true, and I respect what you're saying, but this legislature, which has a tough enough time pulling up enough money to pay for our judicial system, is going to be very much concerned about the impact this is going to have in terms of new judges.
I mean, I share the concern.
Mr. DeWinter, would you get the fiscal impact on this bill?
Madam Chair, I just have one more question. I understood this to explain that there would have to be an agreement between the city and the district court.
As far as the city attorney doing the prosecuting, in other words, to have the district attorney prosecute, you would need a contractual arrangement.
But, well, finish my question.
Yes.
Should this language pass, then the district courts, in fact, would have jurisdiction and therefore could not deny any jurisdiction in these matters. In other words, it would be mandatory for them under their existing documentation.
Well, the policeman would decide the jurisdiction where he cited the first man.
He decides that now in major traffic, of course, it would be the same situation. When you get out of the traffic area, you're getting into an area, for example, of basically municipal ordinance violations being that breach of the peace, the traditional common law type of offenses. If you get into the area of building code, zoning, fire code violations, they're not as common, and you're more likely to find a civil suit simply to get the injunctive process rather than the criminal approach. There are, in fact, provisions now to enforce city ordinances where there are no criminal sanctions attached to it in the circuit court. So I don't think you see a rush to the district court just simply to file a disorderly conduct under these provisions. I do think, and I know the city of Beaverton would consider it, we would discuss it with the district attorney, Mr. Robinette, and also the district judges, and see what would be the best way of actually accommodating the different crimes. As far as the zoning and building violations, probably continue on a civil basis. I would follow the civil litigation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 163. Laird Kirkpatrick.
Roughly the same.
Please the committee. My name is Larry Kirkpatrick. I'm Director of Legal Aid Service in Portland. Our office has a special interest in this proposed consumer class action legislation because it is often low-income consumers who we represent who are most susceptible to commercial wrongs in a small amount, yet who are most injured by having being overcharged or otherwise being damaged in relatively small amounts in consumer transactions. The Oregon Constitution provides that every man shall have a remedy by due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation, but unfortunately this constitutional guarantee is proving to be a hollow one for any Oregon citizens who are overcharged or otherwise damaged in a very small amount by the conduct of a particular seller or creditor.
What's the cite on that? Right?
That's the Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution. The reason why that constitutional provision isn't really adequate for small overcharges is because even though the injury, the overcharges may be enormous in the aggregate, they may be hundreds of thousands of dollars, if the amount of overcharge to an individual consumer is $5, $10, or even $50, that amount is just too small to make it justify the cost of litigation, so the injured consumer under existing Oregon law is forced to forego his claim unless the consumers are allowed to join together and litigate the issue as a class. The primary use of class actions is to recover illegal overcharges in the consumer area. With a very slight overcharge of 1,000 consumers, a $10 overcharge of 1,000 consumers is $10,000 for illegal profit, or it can be much more in many cases. But if the amounts are small as to each individual consumer, it's simply not feasible under existing Oregon law and legal procedures for the consumers to recover these overcharges. This bill, in essence, is simply the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 23. This is not any particularly radical proposal or form of class action. This is the law now in the federal courts in all 50 states in the United States. It's also the law in our neighboring states of the state of Washington, and the state of California has also adopted Rule 23 by court decision. The court looks to Rule 23 in California to decide on class action litigation in California. And in addition, it's also the law in Oregon if somebody is injured by a seller who has violated the federal law, so that the federal court has jurisdiction. So this is a remedy that has been used in many other places in the country, and many citizens of other states have this type of remedy. They can bring a class action to recover illegal overcharges, but Oregon does not allow its consumer citizens to have this kind of relief when they've been overcharged in small amounts. And in Oregon, what happens is the people are simply denied their recovery, and a creditor who's violated a law, as long as it's a state law and not a federal law, is able to retain the illegal profits made by that violation of law as long as the amount of overcharge is so small that the consumers cannot afford the cost of the time going to court and the attorney's fees involved to recover that illegal overcharge. This is why we feel that consumer class action is necessary in Oregon, and there are other people that will be testifying representing other views of consumers on it. Governor McCall has endorsed some type of consumer class action legislation. Mrs. Merrill is here from the governor's office. Mick Shalab is here from the attorney general's office. The Oregon Consumer League will be testifying also. I thought it might be useful to the committee to relate some of the experience that we have had in the consumer class action area. And certainly one case we've been involved in that's been a major consumer class action case in Oregon is the case described in the Oregonian editorial, namely the case of Kelly versus Debt Reducers. As the editorial indicates, this was a consumer class suit on behalf of several thousand customers of one of the largest debt consolidating agencies in Oregon. But Oregon law allows a maximum charge of 15% to the debtor for the services of a debt consolidating agency. This particular agency was found to be taking substantially more than that as its fees. The real estate commissioner intervened and tried to put a stop to the conduct, but there was no way that the real estate commissioner had authority to recover these illegal overcharges. The Attorney General attempted to recover the illegal overcharges on behalf of the class members. The court held that the Attorney General didn't have this authority, so this class action was filed, Kelly versus debt reducers, approximately 2.5 years ago. The court ruled that it was a proper class action at that time. The entire case was litigated. The trial judge found that, yes, indeed, there were overcharges. These debtors, these are the people who go to a debt consolidating agency, I should point out, are generally very low-income people. They're trying to pay off their debts. They're trying to avoid going bankrupt. They're working people that have some small income, and they're attempting to pay off their creditors without going bankrupt. And they're trying to use the services of a debt consolidator, but these thousands of Oregon citizens who were using this particular debt consolidator were found to have been overcharged in amounts ranging between $1 and $150. It averaged out to about $40 of overcharge for each customer. An amount that was just too small for them to recover individually. The court ordered the case at that time, at the beginning of the case, to proceed as a class action, appointed the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner as master. They calculated the overcharges for just a 1.5 year period. The overcharges were over $30,000. The overcharges took place over a 5 year period, so it appears that the total overcharges were over $100,000, yet this company has not had to pay back 1 cent at this point, because under existing Oregon law, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in another case that you cannot have class actions at law, and the trial judge decided that this was a class action at law, and so therefore, even though he found that all these thousands of customers had been overcharged, they'd been sent court notices telling them they'd been overcharged, all of them that were still in the class filed claims requesting recovery of this overcharge, but the court felt compelled, because of lack of legislative authority, to dismiss it as a class action. The named plaintiff that brought the suit was able to recover a judgment, but the hundreds of other class members who were overcharged were told, you've been overcharged, I'm sorry, you have no remedy under Oregon law unless you can afford to bring an individual suit, which of course they couldn't do. So that case is on appeal, but it appears that the courts feel under existing Oregon law that they need more legislative authority before they can allow this type of recovery. Another case handled by our program, to give you just another idea of what it means when we're talking about class actions, and try and, keep it from being an abstract concept. Another case was Hayes versus Roland Associates. This Hayes versus Roland Associates, it involved Filter Queen vacuum cleaners. The Filter Queen vacuum cleaner company was selling door-to-door in Portland. They come from state to state. They're selling in Portland vacuum cleaners for $435 at 22% interest. The testimony at trial was that the wholesale cost of these vacuum cleaners was $85, but they were being sold for $435. A class action was brought to rescind these contracts because of illegal misrepresentations made to the consumers by these door-to-door salesmen of the vacuum cleaner company. The trial judge found that it was true that all the class members had illegal representations made to them, that the sales contracts were unconscionable and tainted with fraud, and the trial judge has ordered those contracts to be canceled. And so this was a successful class suit at the trial level, but now that case has been appealed, and it's very uncertain whether that case will be allowed to stand by the Oregon Supreme Court in light of its most recent case last fall, the American Timber Trading Company case, which held that you just cannot have class actions at law in Oregon.
Was that subsequent to 71 that action was brought?
It was filed in 71.
Well, I mean, was it subsequent to the effective date of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act?
No, it was filed prior to 71.
Couldn't you get federal court jurisdiction on that because of the fact it was an out-of-state corporation?
The problem with federal court for these class actions is that now the federal court will not allow aggregation of claims to get your $10,000 jurisdictional amount, even with diversity. I guess you have to have that $10,000 involved, and the courts won't allow you to aggregate the claims of all the class members to reach the $10,000. Each class member, each consumer, would have to have a $10,000 claim, so diversity makes the federal courts useless for class actions.
Okay.
So this is the problem, why, unless it's a truth in lending, or unless there's some federal statute that's expressly violated that gives the federal court's jurisdiction, the consumers just have no remedy in federal court now, at least in Oregon, but in the neighboring states, they would have this type of remedy. And in fact, in both California and the state of Washington, actions were brought against Filter Queen that were sustained, and as I say, it's very likely to possibly be reversed by the Oregon Supreme Court because of the lack of legislative authority for these types of proceedings. There are various other types of cases that have been brought as class actions in California. In a famous case, Dar versus Yellow Cab, the Yellow Cab company in Los Angeles was found to have rigged meters. public utility commissioner down there found that the taxi cab meters had been deliberately rigged to exaggerate the mileage and pay the cab company illegal fares. A class action was successfully brought in California to keep the cab company from being able to retain these illegal profits under Oregon law. Cab company or any other creditor who violates the statute and deceives a large number of consumers in a small amount would be allowed to retain the illegal profits. And of course, that's what's happened in the debt reducers case and what may happen in the filter clean vacuum cleaner case. Senate Bill 163 would change this. It would allow class actions by consumers to recover damages in small amounts, so that there would be a meaningful form of recovery when a large group of people are injured by illegal conduct that's small as in each individual consumer. Obviously, this is a bill that's generated a lot of controversy, and I'm sure that the opponents of the legislation have various objections. I would merely like to say that, first, there, with regard to any alleged abuses under class actions in other states, there's always another side to the story, and if anybody is concerned about a particular example, we appreciate an opportunity to discuss the type of case, the full situation, because it is true that some frivolous suits get filed class actions, but the judges throw them out. I mean, I could name several suits where a suit may have been filed that was frivolous, but the judge didn't allow it to proceed. In terms of the class actions that have really been allowed to proceed and become actual class actions, most of them in other states have involved very substantive issues and where consumers had been injured in one way or another. But the second point with regard to any possible dangers that Oregon businesses may feel with regard to legislation such as this, even though it hasn't proved to be a problem in some of the other states, could be remedied by amendment. We've met with some of the opponents of the bill, the representatives of Penney's and Montgomery Ward's. We've talked over some of the problems, and I think any possible abuses can be eliminated by amendment. I don't think that it's simply a choice of class actions or no class actions. If there are particular problems or particular concerns, I feel very strongly that they can be dealt with by amendment. And we do have some possible amendments that we'd like to offer the committee. I'll submit copies of them to the committee that we have worked out in several hours of negotiations with some of the opponents of class actions to try and eliminate the problems that they would have with them. I think two of the most important amendments would be, one, to not allow...
Why don't you pass them out, Larry?
Fine.
You don't have that thing there.
These would be for discussion. I'm not sure we would endorse all the amendments at this point, but I think we're pretty close to agreement on these. They may need some additional drafting, I think they would solve a lot of the problems. I think the two most important objections made to class actions will be dealt with by these amendments, or the two amendments I will just briefly discuss. The one amendment involves not allowing class actions where there are minimum damages. Many people feel it's oppressive, and I would agree, to allow a class action on behalf of 1,000 consumers for a minimum statutory penalty, such as $100 under the Truth in Lending Act, or a violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act in Oregon, which has a $200 minimum penalty. If you allowed 1,000 consumers to recover $100 each or $200 each when they weren't necessarily damaged in that amount, that might be oppressive. So this bill allows, one of the amendments in these amendments would allow class actions only for the actual damages suffered, and wouldn't allow class actions for minimum penalties, for minimum statutory penalties. And so that would eliminate that abuse, which I know is of great concern to many opponents.
I think I hit all my comments.
Here's one here. This one. Take
a look. I'm not going to pass anything more for you all session. Remember, you told me you wouldn't do that for me.
Yeah, but I lied to you. I've done it twice already.
I know. You're not.
I was bad, Roy.
This would be on page 5, section 9.
Very good.
The class action may not be maintained for recovery of statutory minimum penalties for any class member, as provided in ORS 646, which is Oregon's Deceptive Trade Practices Act, or in 15 U.S.C. 1640, which is the Truth in Lending Statute, providing for a minimum of $100 penalties. If you did aggregate minimum penalties, minimum statutory penalties for consumers, it could get to be overwhelming. And the federal courts, frankly, under Truth in Lending now, aren't allowing those anyway. The courts haven't been allowing class actions for Truth in Lending violations anyway, feeling that there isn't a need for class actions in that type of situation. So I don't think there would really be a problem even if this amendment weren't enacted, because this is basically what the courts have been ruling. But if it would help ease the concern of anybody, I think that amendment would be entirely acceptable and would avoid any problem there of a class action for a minimum statutory penalty. The other amendment that I think is especially important is Section 10 on page 5, which would limit attorney's fees. Many people feel concerned that class actions are used by attorneys as a means of recovering large attorney's fees, and that this encourages possibly frivolous class actions being filed. Under Section 10, the attorney's fees would have to be established by the court, would have to be approved by the court, and would have to be reasonable in amount. And so you couldn't have a contingent fee class action where an attorney says, well, I'll take that class action for you if I can get 40% of the fee, and just take a flyer on some class action that may not be very well founded. This would require the court to approve the amount of the attorney's fees, and thereby not make them any more profitable or less profitable than any other type of work for attorneys, and I think this would eliminate any problem with class action.
You're getting ahead of me. How could you maintain a class action based on the substantive federal law? I recognize what the amendment, the first one we talked about, the courts do, but I would assume that absent that, find that you can bring a class action, under this bill, you can bring a class action in Oregon for a violation of 15 U.S.C. 1640.
No, that would be excluded. You could not bring a class action for prison money.
You couldn't anyway.
I think there's a special provision that surprised me when I read it, but you can sue in state court for violation of the Truth in Lending Act. Most people go to federal court because it's easier, but the federal Truth in Lending statute does allow jurisdiction in both the state and federal courts. And so we often assert it as counterclaims in our collection suits, for example, but state courts have jurisdiction.
If we adopted that by reference in our civil procedural code?
No, I think the federal law provides.
Can the federal court vest jurisdiction in state courts for violation of federal statutes?
I think they cannot require the state courts to, but if they don't make it exclusive to federal courts, then if the current state procedure permits it, then you could.
Well, does our current state procedure permit it?
Apparently it's going on.
I'm familiar with several cases where the state courts have ruled a violation of federal law is cognizant of the state courts.
I didn't hear what was said, but it provides for class suits in equity, doesn't it? But not at law.
Well, it's the difference.
That's right. But certainly this would avoid that problem. You wouldn't, even regardless of whether you could bring an individual case in state court, definitely couldn't bring a federal class action to violation of federal law.
Well, back up, and I hate to ask a lot of questions, but I want to get educated in the course of this discussion. If your Rowland versus Hayes Associates or whatever it was had been brought after the effective date of the 71 passed consumer protection law, why wouldn't it have been just as good for the aggrieved parties to pursue their remedy under that against the vacuum cleaner companies and avail themselves of their remedy there?
Well, it's a good question. You couldn't have had a class action on the subtractor. It could have been an individual case, and if there had been 1,000, if all 1,000 consumers had gone to court, of course, it would have just all of the dockets. You'd have 1,000 different lawyers down, 1,000 cases being tried, 1,000 different lawyers, 1,000 cases litigating virtually the identical issue.
But it's likely that the individual consumer who is aggrieved would probably get his attorneys, get his statutory punitive damages or whatever it is, and probably would have come out better. It probably would have been a whole lot more costly for the fraudulent vacuum cleaner company, because they'd be defending 1,000 cases. I mean, I'm really not trying to put you on, but I'm just trying to sort it out.
No, I think that's a legitimate question. I think the problem with that is that, first, it would overwhelm the court. Secondly, there are many, it might work in the filter clean vacuum cleaner, because I think we probably could find one of the subcategories of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act that was violated there, but in a lot of in many cases of overcharges, for example, there's not the element of fraud that there was in the vacuum cleaner case. Like the debt reducer case, for example, I don't think would have been a violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act in any way. There was an illegal overcharge, but it didn't violate any of the provisions of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And the same thing would be true for many other types of consumer overcharges. If it was an overcharge, it may be illegal, but it yet may not be a violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act because it just doesn't fit in any of the categories.
We could amend that to include usury as a person who had a cause of action for usury standing under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and that would get around that, wouldn't it?
Well, of course, I don't know if even the debt reducer's case would be usury or some of the other, the rigged taxicab meter case in Los Angeles. I don't know if that would be usury. It's a violation of either law or rule or
sure,
something.
Sure, it's usury.
Well,
of course, I sponsored Bill 67 to make usury a criminal penalty, and I didn't get very far with that either. But sure, they're charging more than they should.
Well, it certainly depends on the definition of usury. I'm thinking the technical statutory definition, which only applies to statutory interest rates, but on the broad definition of usury, if you mean just any illegal overcharge, if you could word something like that, it might be helpful to consumers that knew of that, that knew of a lawyer. But I think there are many consumers now that don't know about the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and still feel, even though they feel they've been cheated by a vacuum cleaner salesman or anybody else, don't know that they're not going to have to pay more to an attorney if they take it to an attorney. Most people would still feel that if I go, I cannot afford to see an attorney about this problem because they'll charge me more than the amount I've been cheated by the vacuum cleaner company. So they still aren't using that Deceptive Trade Practices Act very much, unfortunately. We're disappointed that it's not being used more, but it's been our experience. The court docket in Multnomah County has been very light on Deceptive Trade Practices Act cases. Many lawyers don't even know about statutory attorney's fees there, let alone the injured consumers. At least that's been our experience.
Further questions? Thank you. Mr. Kirkpatrick.
Thank
you. Charles Mervin.
Madam Chairman, my name is Charles Mervin. I'm a partner at the law firm at Marmaduke, Ashenbrenner, Mervin, and Saltpine, Portland, which is a certified by the Oregon State Bar Association as a public interest law firm. That essentially means that we have agreed with the Bar Association that at least 50% of our time will be spent in public interest areas. And we have defined those areas as environment, civil rights, and consumer. It further means we have an income limitation on our net annual proceeds.
Senator Smith, can I have your proxy for this bill?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
I gave it to John Burns.
Previous to that time, I was the director of legal aid services in Multnomah County, and previous to that, I was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I've been in practice law going on 10 years now, and in all those three capacities that I've mentioned, the problems of consumers have come to my attention. I recall as a deputy district attorney, we had a so-called walk-in trade where people would simply come into our office feeling that the district attorney was supposed to represent members of the public on any issue, civil or criminal. And a great many of those people who came in on a walk-in basis had consumer fraud problems. They were complaining about shady merchants, door-to-door salesmen, car mechanics, TV repairmen, and so forth. And our only response at that time was simply, you have to see a private attorney. Well, as a result of my other experience, it's quite clear that when you're talking about a potential recovery for an individual for anything under $500, you really will find very few attorneys who can afford their time on a contingent fee basis. And the end result is you either charge an hourly rate, which makes it prohibitive to the consumer involved, or you do it on a pro bono or free basis, simply because you feel that the person was cheated so badly that something ought to be done, which means that attorneys in private practice who do this thing, one are few in number, and two can't afford to take many cases on that kind of basis. as I see the Oregon law as a result of the recent Oregon Supreme Court decision, we now have a very big void as far as protection of consumers. We simply cannot combine potential plaintiffs together in a class action to recover damages for a breach of contract or fraud or any other means. I have discussed at length with Laird Kirkpatrick and Charlie Williams their proposed amendments to Rule 23, which is the bill in question. My personal preference, I think, is to urge the adoption of Rule 23 as is, for the simple reason that the law is well settled as to what Rule 23 means. Federal courts in the various states around the nation that adopted Rule 23 have had case law for some time, and lawyers will know and judges will know what the rule means. The amendments that have been proposed by the Legal Aid Service, however, I think generally are good. In the first place, I don't advocate any bill which is unfair to any segment of our society. I don't think that the legislature here has any business adopting a lawyer's bill, a bill that whose prime purpose, either for motivation or the effect of the bill, is to make large sums of money for individuals who specialize in class action work. On the other hand, I think the fundamental question before this committee is whether it is fair, morally right, for a consumer to have to suffer a loss, which is small in amount, simply because, one, the loss is small, and two, the person who has wrongfully gained the money is large and can afford expensive litigation, which precludes any type of recovery on the part of the consumer. I think a balance can be struck, and I think the amendments proposed meet that balance. On the one hand, you have the fly-by-night situation, which nobody is in favor of not stopping. You have out-of-state large financial institutions or businesses which have large financial backing who operate out-of-state, that come into the state of Oregon, not violating any federal law, but taking away small bits of money from Oregon residents. An example of that, which an associate of mine handled in our firm, was a California-based correspondence school, which had as a subject matter how conservation and how you become a Forest Service fellow and so forth, and things dealing with the ecology. And they had, in their written material, listed various organizations such as the Wilderness Society and Isaac Walton League as sponsors or people who had approved their subject matter. This turned out to be false. In fact, the alleged sponsors or endorsers of the program had written letters to this company demanding that their names be removed from the pamphlets. Nevertheless, they were not removed. We brought, as a class action originally in state court here, action seeking to recover the money that Oregon plaintiffs or Oregon residents had paid in. Judge Dale, following the recent Oregon decision, ruled that it could not be brought as a class action. There was no federal jurisdiction there. We could not have gotten in federal court, even though there was diversity, because you need $10,000 per individual as a claim. So we have a situation.
Did you sue them individually, Charlie? Did you sue on behalf of your client?
Sure, and we recovered. That was no problem. But the fact is, that's not an economic detriment to this company, and they're free to continue in other, even in the Portland area, simply because, one, a lawyer can't advertise, hey, this is illegal, anybody who's got this problem, come in to see me.
Is that outfit licensed by the state to do business in the state?
It was licensed by the state.
Okay. Then did you use the basis of your recovery against them as a means of going against their license to kick them out of the state?
To kick them out of the state, we referred, there's an agency here.
Too damn many of them, for one thing. But
the people who are in charge of correspondence schools and other schools where you learned by written material. We refer the complaint on, I didn't handle the case, so I'm not familiar as to what happened to the following. Well, the point I'm trying to make is Oregon businesses certainly have, legitimate Oregon businesses have legitimate concerns about any class action bill. One concern is this. If somebody files a lawsuit against this class action, reporters go bananas about class action, and this is reported, and this hurts our business reputation. One, we may not be guilty of the charge or practice alleged, or two, it may have been an inadvertent mistake done by a single employee for a small number of people, and it doesn't warrant class action. I think the amendment proposed by the Legal Services Program, which requires a pre-filing notice, 30 days, in which you notify the company involved or the potential defendant that you are accused of doing this, and this is in violation of the law because of a certain section of the code or whatever, and you have 30 days in which to rectify and to return any money that might have been illegally obtained or stop the practice, is certainly a sufficient protection against legitimate Oregon concerns to avoid the bad publicity problem. I further feel that the amendment, which would limit an attorney's fees to a reasonable amount to be determined by the court and not by a private agreement between the attorney and his single representative plaintiff on behalf of all the potential plaintiffs, is appropriate.
Give me that again. Run that by me again.
All right. It's conceivable that you could get a court to agree that on a $100,000 recovery from defendant A on behalf of 200 plaintiffs or 2,000 plaintiffs, that you ought to have a percentage on a contingent fee basis. And I think around the country there have been some attorney's fees granted on that basis, on a percentage of the recovery. I don't think, I put it this way, I do not oppose a limitation where the court, one, is empowered to set the fee for the plaintiff's attorney, and two, that fee is not going to be on a contingent basis, but it's going to be based on what the court feels is a reasonable value of his time and his work, which is the way the amendment reads. In other words, in any case where you have statutory fees, the court now sets the reasonable fee. In a divorce case, for instance, the attorney, I might represent a woman who I might, just between her and myself, I would agree to, say, $500, but the court sets a $250 fee.
I had a case, Madam Chairman. How is it now in the federal court? The court sets the fees, right?
On a class action?
Yeah. It's not based on a contingency.
Assuming that fees are allowed in the first place, which is by virtue of some other statute, then the court sets the fee. Like the truth in lending cases, the court sets the fee. This is to be distinguished, Senator Burns, from cases that have been brought in federal court where there's a settlement that's been made between the plaintiff and the defendant.
All right.
And the defendant says, as part of the settlement, I'm willing to pay X amount of thousands of dollars.
Cascade Rolling Mills. Remember that case?
I'm not familiar with that case.
Well, I wonder if that was a class action. Because there was a settlement. It was a class action because there was a settlement between the plaintiff's attorney and the defendant's attorney with respect to fees, and the fees used up all the assets of the company, and a friend of mine who happens to be an attorney, who happened also to be a stockholder in the company, objected to the agreement on attorney's fees, and the federal court heard the objection, but nevertheless allowed the attorney's fees agreed upon between counsel. You're not familiar with that.
I'm not familiar with that, but I'll tell you this. It is a difficult thing for a judge to say, I disapprove of this fee that the plaintiff and the defendant has agreed upon. And that is why this amendment, I think, would obviate that particular problem. I think the amendment specifically provides that the fee is totally within the control of the court, and that a proposed settlement, he's going to determine the fee based upon the time involved and the work involved, and not on an agreement between the defendant and the plaintiff's attorney. I think that should be clear, that the fee ought to be totally within the discretion of the court, and if you run into courts that might be liberal, that's a problem for the defendant. If you run into courts that might be conservative about fees, that's a problem for the plaintiff's attorney. But I agree that the law ought not to be that certain small segments of the population can make their living off of people who are in business. On the other hand, I think the fundamental question is it at all fair or moral to allow people, because of their economic size and because of the small amount of money they involve, to obtain money or to retain money they've wrongfully obtained? It's just, to me, a simple moral question. Now, the problem of how to handle that, I think, stated, has been covered by these amendments, particularly the one that takes away bad publicity from a legitimate concern that in good faith, as the bill states, gives them a good faith opportunity to rectify, without filing the suit, any deficiencies involved. And also, with putting the control of that fee and taking it out of the hands of the plaintiff's attorney. That's really what it does. It takes it out of the hands of the plaintiff's attorney. And furthermore, the minimum penalty statute, such as Consumer Protection Act, I think also that is a legitimate amendment, that you shouldn't have a class action to recover a minimum penalty of $200 when the actual loss might have been $1 or $10 to each individual plaintiff. I think what they're entitled to is what they got, what they lost. Now, if they want to bring individual actions, they will have the opportunity to do when they receive their notice, in which they can go in there with vindication and get their minimum $200. Senator Burns, you raised the question of why not use the Deceptive Trade Practices Act for individual actions. And I think Mr. Kirkpatrick was correct in saying, one, there's a tremendous ignorance on the part of the consumer, even with all the efforts of the Attorney General and the Governor's Office and the consumer protection people to educate the public. There's still a tremendous ignorance on the part of the consumers what they can do effectively. Secondly, as an attorney, I think you probably are aware of the fact that people are afraid to go in the attorney's office. They're afraid that when they go in there, it's going to cost them $100 before they get out. And for that reason, when you're talking about a man who says, gee, I just got ripped off for $10 on this shoddy whatever because he lied to me, he is not going to take the problem of taking his time off during a working day or send his wife down and hire a babysitter. Talk to an attorney because he's afraid it's going to cost him $50 before he gets out of that office. And that's why the class action, I think, is the only vehicle by which defendants who wrongfully obtain money can be compelled to reimburse the people they've obtained.
I have an awful lot of people call me with those kinds of complaints, so, I agree. There's something that's
questions.
I wonder if there's ever been any consideration given to packing or jurisdictional limits with respect to amount. I don't know anything about class action.
That there was a, you mean in federal court?
Well, or even here. I'm concerned about, I don't know, 10 people that were in the class and yet the defendant being required to spend a whole lot of money in terms of mailing out notice and stuff like that. I want some correlation between the amount of money and the cost.
Well, I think in federal court, and I've read cases to that effect, although I don't remember the particular citation, this is whether or not the class for money damages is class action is the most appropriate remedy is a specific consideration. And when a class action is filed, it's not automatically a class action. There has to be a hearing to determine whether it's appropriate to proceed. At that point, if it be true that, say, the amount of money involved per individual was 5 cents, and the defendant can more or less make at least a prima facie showing of that, or preliminary showing, then say, to mail out notice, or to publish notice, is going to cost twice as much as the total amount of money involved, then I certainly think it would be appropriate for the court to, in that kind of situation, say, this is not an appropriate remedy. I'll give you an injunction, maybe.
Well, Charlie, that's covered in these amendments.
Right.
Same type of...
All right, that's a question.
Further questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Gillette. Senator Brown, members of the committee. I'm Mick Gillette. I'm Chief Counsel for Attorney General Lee Johnson's Consumer Protection Division. Madam Chairman, it would appear that anyone who agrees to go third after Mr. Kirkpatrick and Mr. Merton can't have a great deal else to say, at least if he's appearing in support of this measure. I would like to point out a couple of things in response to questions from Senator Burns, which I think might help demonstrate the need for this legislation in view of the coverage of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. There are at least two different kinds of problems which we have seen arise in our office fairly frequently, which are not covered by the Act, and which involve a large number of people and common questions of law and fact. The first is the sale of business opportunities, which are not covered by the Act. Classic example is Costco, for instance, which is the sale of a business opportunity that's not covered by the Act. Similar pyramid organizations are also not covered at present, although we hope they will be if the legislature sees fit to enact a technical amendment to our Act, which we propose. Another kind of problem that arises is a purely contractual issue in which someone on one side makes a contract with a whole number of people intending to abide by it at the time he enters into the contract, but later chooses not to. He's still solvent. He's perfectly capable of carrying out the terms of the contract, but just doesn't want to. We had a recent complaint involving a company which was supplying propane to a community in eastern Clackamas County, and had somewhere between 50 and 200 customers. It had entered into an agreement with them to provide the propane and the tank to hold the propane, and the tank would be free. The company later unilaterally decided to change the agreement and charge for the use of the tank because it found it wasn't making enough money. Well, each of the individuals involved individually was losing something like $1 a month and could hardly justify a lawsuit, but together, perhaps they could have. Kind of thing which we couldn't deal with because under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, in order for us to have jurisdiction, there must have been a violation essentially ab initio at the time the agreement that's involved was entered into. And in these cases, we had a classic situation where the agreement was entered into and then one side decided to back out. So you had a large enough class, common issues, law and fact, a need for a remedy, but nobody could afford it. And we think that under those circumstances, the availability of rule like Federal Rule 23 is particularly appropriate. So I'm appearing on behalf of Attorney General Johnson today, Madam Chairman, to endorse the concept which is represented by Senate Bill 163. We are particularly in favor of the bill if it receives the amendments which have been discussed by Mr. Kirkpatrick and Mr. Mertens relating to 30-day notice, relating to penalties, and relating to the establishment of attorney's fees by the court rather than by the attorney.
Senator Johnson.
I am getting tired of executive representatives coming before committees saying, I appear here to endorse, or my boss appears here to endorse concept. Because that way, if you're a politician, you can be all things to all people. Now, I'm not taking the Attorney General on because that's the first time that a representative of his office appear in front of the committee on which I serve to say that. Do I understand, however,
that if the amendments proposed by Mr. Kirkpatrick are adopted, that the Attorney General would then support the bill?
No. Let me explain myself. I'm not a politician. I'm sorry to abuse the phrase.
I'm not either.
We are in favor of the bill as proposed. We are in favor of the amendments which have been discussed, and those in principle, because I haven't had a chance to read them yet thoroughly enough to give them sufficient analysis to say we favor that exact wording, and that's why I used that phrase. But we're in favor of the bill as it's been offered. We also feel that the proposed amendments are appropriate in view of what we think are legitimate considerations.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Keith Burns.
I will often come to the defense of the Attorney General, but there's some history on this, John, that might be helpful. That class actions were discussed with the Attorney General by myself, and he said he was in favor of getting a class action bill in. He invited groups of people who ordinarily would be opposed to class action to meet with him. They refused. They didn't come in and meet with him. And I held up on this bill until they had that opportunity. They didn't come in. And so then he agrees with me. The thing to do is to drop it in. We dropped it in. Then they gathered. And that's the result is this large body of work that's been worked out cooperatively between Legal Aid and Charlie Merton and people who are generally not in favor of class actions, but are primarily interested in eliminating the abuses of class action.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gillette. I'm going to skip down to the opponents at the moment, since they are from out of town, and those people who are from in town will be called later. Is it Mr. Bates?
Yes. Madam Chairman, a member of the committee. My name is Hugh Biggs. I live in Portland. I'm a lawyer and a partner in the law firm of Davies, Biggs, Spear, Stowe, and Bowley. We're counsel for the United States National Bank. My personal experience has been in connection with the defense of the lending action by the bank. I am here this afternoon to speak in opposition to the bill as it is drafted, believing that the amendments that have been offered are very desirable amendments, but they do not go quite far enough. I'm speaking now.
Do you have the amendments, Mr. Biggs?
They were handed to me after I came into the room, and I checked through them to see if they corresponded with the draft of the bill. One of my partners has handed me containing what I think are essentially those amendments. I wanted to say, in opposition to one of the comments that was made, that the Rule 23 in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is certainly not a uniformly in California, and he alleges that as a result of that, damage is done to health,
garden, this, that, and the other thing. You've got then, we'll say, 10 million people who are by unilateral action of the lawyer who has the case, members of a class action, if the court permits the class action. Well, the court has to consider many things in determining whether that's an appropriate class action or not. If he decides that it is, then the question, how do we get notice to these 10 million members of the class who may or may not be affected? It's alleged in the complaint that they're all affected one way or the other. How are they affected? Of course, up against the problem then of getting some kind of a notice. You may decide that an adequate notice would be an ad in all the newspapers saying such an action has been filed. Anyone who suffered damage of this kind or that kind are members of the class, unless they specifically opt out. Maybe a great many of those people will not even have seen that notice. That's one of the things that the court is concerned about. And they decide to fly a balloon over the county 3 days a week announcing the fact that a class action is pending. Or in the case of the taxi drivers, the taxi cab case that did come up in California, they gave consideration to making the taxi cabs put in each cab. There is now a class action pending against this taxi cab company for overcharging customers. You feel you're overcharged, you may be a member of the class or are a member of the class unless you opt out. The result is, of course, that a great many, I'm giving you exaggerated cases, and you recognize that, Senator Burns, but these are cases that are presently on the books. In a situation of that kind, you've got an almost unmanageable and impossible case in the beginning. May very well be in the cases first set that people first spoke about, that people living in the immediate vicinity of the polluting company defendant may decide that they do have debt. If so, is there any reason why they then, upon receipt of the notice, why they then shouldn't immediately file notice with the court? We opt in. We want to be a member of this class. And be prepared to assert what their claim is. The court then can determine, after an adequate amount of time has been given to these people to say whether they want to be a member of the class, what the nature of the class is, what the nature of the damages are. Is it the kind of an action that we can maintain as a class action because of the commonality of damages? Or is it going to be impossible because this man claims that his dog died, another man claims that his bushes died as a result of pollutants, another one claims that his house, that his wife was hospitalized as a result of it, and you have maybe hundreds of diverse claims that do not represent common issues of fact. But at least the court knows what it's doing from the beginning. The defendant knows what his problem is, and there it becomes then a much more manageable class than if you go ahead on the theory that anybody who didn't opt out expressly go to the trouble of writing to the court to say we don't want to be a member of this class automatically becomes a member of the class. That's an unrealistic thing. It's contrary to our whole theory of adjudication of controversies. There's got to be a controversy. Why bring in hundreds of people who simply don't opt out, but who have no interest or claim against the defendant at all, and put everybody to the expense of treating them as defendants, some of them that may not even be known? I think that is the matter that has been overlooked, and I think deliberately, because I'm sure that the proponents of the bill have considered this very thing and have decided that they do not want to require such affirmative action of these putative class members, because if they did, there wouldn't be enough of them to show an interest in it to make it worth their while to proceed with the lawsuit. This
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Things. Many years ago, I had some iron fireman stock and got sucked into the deal with electronic specialty.
Yes.
And got rid of the electronic specialty stock, fortunately, before it started going down the drain. But after I got sold my electronic specialty stock, I started getting letters from the Federal District Court in Chicago concerning the class action that had been brought
derivative.
Against...
Derivative. What
I
don't know. I'm just asking.
I thought maybe you knew about the case.
No,
what,
I do not.
The correspondence that I got, maybe it was a derivative suit. That's what it was. Asking me to affirmatively respond if I wanted to participate.
Right.
It was not a class action, it was a derivative suit.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you have illustrated the point.
That's right.
You knew
Biggs, United States National Bank was a defendant in a class action.
Yes.
Was it not?
Yes, it was.
And did you have difficulty determining who were the members of the class?
No, we did not in that instance. This was a suit based upon an alleged violation of the Truth in Lending Act by the form of the notice card, billing cards that went out each month. The Truth in Lending Act is a highly technical, the provisions of the Act and the regulations passed under it are highly technical. They require cards to be of a particular size, that the interest rate should also be of a particular size, that the balance due should be set off in such a way that it couldn't confuse the customer with what the monthly payment was instead of the overall balance due. There was a great deal of difficulty in fitting the card to meet those specifications, and at the same time to have it in to be able to put it through a computer. It had been approved by the control of the currency and one of the federal agencies, but that wasn't adequate. So we were faced then, the United States National Bank was faced with defending a class action with a statutory penalty of $100 if there had been any technical violation of that statute for, guys, don't hold me to this number, I think it was 200,000 customers. But we had then the names of everyone who had one of our cards, the Bank of America card, and had made use of it. You see, and it was from that record that the number was ascertained and the notice was sent to them. I think out of that and the expense of mailing that notice, I've forgotten. It was just an awful lot of money, as you can imagine. But the response was almost negative.
But there was a class action brought against you in
state. Class action brought against
us in the state court.
No, ma'am.
Was
the interest. I think you're thinking of the action brought against the First National Bank for computing interest on 360 instead of 365 days. That action was brought. It was dismissed because of what was said here earlier. Our procedure does not permit a class action, but it does a suit. But just to go ahead with the other, we had no difficulty. Yes.
Senator Keith
Burns. These amendments by that kind of a class action there in the first place couldn't be maintained because it excludes class actions for the recovery of statutory minimum penalties. And also, under these amendments, you would get a 30-day notice prior to the time they bring suit. You could correct it.
There
wouldn't be any contracts at all, right?
And I think those are very desirable amendments, Senator, and I think the others in which you limit the recovery of damage to the actual damages are desirable, and I think the other amendment in which you allow the court to fix a reasonable attorney's fee based upon the time and the service rendered is desirable. Those make it a much more acceptable deal on the merits, and they incorporate the criticisms that the College of Trial Lawyers have made of the Act. You do not, however, in this bill, adopt the opt-in or opt-out procedure, and I think that is very essential to making it not only a work
equitable, but a fair bill. Because if a person who receives a notice feels, and this notice tells him exactly what the case is, what the basis of the claim is, what his recovery might be, what his obligations are, if he wants to be in, why shouldn't he be required to be in? And if he doesn't want to be in, and I mean required to notify the court that he's in, and if he doesn't want to be in, why should the attorneys who are maintaining the class action use the numbers of those people who are disinterested in it as a club to force some kind of a settlement against the defendant? And it's frequently done that way. If your numbers are so large and the defendant doesn't know what he's going to be faced with, they'll settle rather than going ahead to try it on its merits. And of the cases in the federal courts, and there have been many of them, almost overwhelming, of course, it was said at a meeting that I attended just a few weeks ago down in Coronado that not one case had actually gone to trial on the merits. But they had all been settled because the defendant had no other way out. They had caused the publication. I'm quoting somebody else. I'm not verifying that, but that statement was made, and I know that many of them were settled just as we settled our lawsuit in going in. Well, that's the point that I wanted to make, particularly on this bill. If you're going to pass a bill, I think in fairness to everyone, it should be, it should include the opt-in provision. Anyone who's to be a member of that class ought to be, to have asserted his willingness to be a member.
Like when I got the notice from the federal court, I had to sign it and say that I wanted to be a part of it. Affirmative.
Now, may I have just a minute to speak aside from this bill? I think that Dr. Burns and the attorneys for the legal aid have really tried by their amendments to make it workable, and I am not challenging their good faith at all in this whole thing. I'm just talking about what I think lawyers and judges are going to be confronted with. First, with that addition, opt-in provision, and the other amendments that are made, I think it's as good a class action bill as could be adopted at this time. My second objection, however, is the timeliness of the bill. And I mean by that, the attempt to borrow from the federal rules of civil procedure one element of them without the context of all of the other procedural rules in the rules of civil procedure. We do not have that. We're a code-pleading state. We do not have the extensive discovery that is permitted under the federal rules of civil procedure, where attorneys can get the, in either preparing their case for trial, either prosecuting or defending it, can file interrogatories, get information, can file requests for permission, have an enlarged liberal right to require the other side to produce books and documents and all that sort of thing. That's very essential, I think. We also have in the federal rules summary judgments. We have a great deal more flexibility on the part of the courts in determining what the issues are through pre-trial procedures. None of that we have in our code pleading. I think we should have. I think the time has come to revise our code, to bring it into line more with the federal rules of civil procedure. But that's going to be a rather expensive process, and I think it is an authority that should be vested in the Supreme Court. That is, to give the Supreme Court rulemaking power so far as practice and procedure are concerned.
We have that bill.
There is a bill before the legislature, and I just wrote to some members of that committee endorsing the bill, and I took the liberty of citing the class action bill before your committee as an illustration of why the rulemaking power should be in the Supreme Court, why it's necessary to do that, because I think that the courts would be overwhelmed
courts have referred to some of these class action bills as monstrosities, that they just cannot handle them. Even the federal courts have done that. We have no chance of doing, of managing them with our limited rules of procedure and practice under our code pleading statute. So while this bill, while that was recognized by the people who have been working on this bill, and they attempted to incorporate by amendment some rulemaking authority in the Supreme Court, it doesn't go far enough. It just goes to coordinating class actions, giving the Supreme Court the power to coordinate for trial in a central location class actions that may be pending throughout the state. But it doesn't provide the tools that judges and lawyers have got to have when they deal with litigation as complex as class action litigation.
Washington has the federal rules.
Washington does have the federal rules.
California has...
Does not have the federal rules. It has its own pleading, and I just, this meeting that I attended was a meeting in San Diego. A whole day was given to a discussion of this matter, and among the most violent protesters of the class action rule, which has been adopted in California out of the context of the other federal civil rules of procedure, was just the thing I'm talking about. There was a judge of the Supreme Court of California who addressed himself the problem, a judge of the Superior Court, and a judge of the Court of Appeals, and they said they're finding it unmanageable. There are no rules of guidance to guide these courts. They've got courts from all over the state going different ways and feeling frustrations because they do not have the flexibility that the rules of federal rules of civil procedure give the courts.
Well, if we had the federal rules, we wouldn't be fooling around with all the amendments that we're making to the procedure.
That's right. And I think the time has come, maybe, when consideration should be given to that. And I think that it's really a mistake to pass part of the federal rules as complex and complicated as this class action rule is outside the context of the whole... Federal.
Other questions of Mr. Bates? Thank you, Mr. Bates. Mr. O'Leary?
Madam Chairman, committee members, I'm Prentice O'Leary, attorney from Los Angeles. I am speaking today on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Retail Council. I am the person who, along with Mr. Ron Lowe, who the chairwoman saw testify to the other committee, have been working with the employee people. Do not repeat everything that, right now I'm still trying to sort out in my mind everything that we've heard today. I think we've heard an awful lot in reflection of different points of view. Let me make the first point in that the Federal Consumer Credit Protection Act, which is Truth in Lending, grants concurrent jurisdiction to both state and federal courts, and that's why that issue came up. Now, I think one thing that hasn't really been discussed about Rule 23 is, first of all, the scope of Rule 23. We've heard about consumer class action. A consumer class action is, as they were described to you today, is in a limited area. Your Federal Rule 23 in the form of SB 163, and I'm probably going to make the mistake of referring to Rule 23 and the subdivisions of that as opposed to the way they've been renumbered in the bill. But Federal Rule 23, if enacted as SB 163, will apply to everything. Securities actions, any common law, antitrust, fraud, any statutory action, particularly susceptible or any regulated industry and the state, all governmental agencies, and not just from consumers, and not in the type of consumer class action we're talking about. Another area that I think is, I'm not that familiar with Oregon environment law, but I've been informed that it's outstanding environment law. It's a regulatory public enforcement law. an unregulated class action provision in relation to environmental class action for damages under B3, which is section 2C, could have a serious effect upon the development of further improvements of your environmental quality law. And it, I think that that's a factor, it's collateral to these issues that must be considered by the committee. Okay, now, what is Rule 23 and what's the source of, which is the source of 163, where does it come from, and what is all the theory behind it? Federal Rule 23 is part of the United States Supreme Court adopted rules of federal procedure, and we all know what those are. Now, Rule 23 was amended in 1966 to resolve problems that existed under the rule at that time, and they had what were called true hybrid and spurious class actions. The name spurious was used in relation to that type of class action that is now a B3, or is under section 2C of 163, because it wasn't a true class action. And this is, people may quibble about the American Timber case, but when they're talking about a representative suit in equity, that was what we called a true class action. Your hybrid class action is in the nature of a declaratory relief or a situation where you want one determination will apply to a group of people. A spurious class action, as prior to 66, was basically a wide permissive joinder section. There were problems involved with the rule. It was amended into the form that it is before you in 163 is printed. Now, at the time, the advisory committee observed that the purpose of the bill was to achieve the economies of time, effort, and expense without sacrificing procedural fairness or bringing about other undesirable results. This is in 39 FRB 98 and 102-103. What we look at then is, has Rule 23 worked? You look at Morris versus Burchan, the 1971 case, where it'll tell you that, at least to that court's knowledge, no securities or antitrust class action under B3 had ever been litigated to a conclusion on the issue of damages.
Since 66.
Under B3, which revised in one, the amended Rule 23. I can't tell you up to date whether that has changed. I've been informed that it has not. Now, as observed earlier, that in the federal courts, you cannot have what was denominated as a consumer class action because of the Snyder versus Harris ruling on aggregation of damages. You must meet the $10,000 minimum jurisdictional requirement in federal court. Now, you don't have that type of requirement here. So you're small claims can be aggregated in a class action under Rule 23. Now, 23 is one of many rules.
Well, run that by us again. You say small.
Okay.
I thought that case held that you couldn't have
Snyder in federal court.
Yeah, and now you say you can. Now, I don't
state court.
I think he was referring to SB 163. I think he misspoke himself.
Well, does 163
SB 163
require for jurisdiction?
There's no jurisdictional requirement that you have a claim, each individual have a claim of $10,000.
Oh, I understand
so
that.
You wouldn't have, the issue involved in Snyder versus Harris wouldn't be presented in the state proceeding.
Right.
Unless a court interpreted that the basic jurisdictional amount of your district court, $5,000 amount in controversy or more, or whatever the amount of controversy. Unless they said that claim had to be met and you couldn't tax claims to get over that jurisdictional amount. Rule 23 is mentioned just a moment ago. You have a lot of different provisions that the rule depends upon for operation. Summary judgment, discovery. You cannot prosecute nor defend in a meaningful manner a class action without having the full range of discovery, both for the plaintiff and defendant. And I understand Oregon would not have those types of provisions. You have, in the federal court, an interlocutory appeals procedure, which is included in the amendment.
Well, Mr. O'Leary, Madam Chairman, I'm sensitive to the argument that you make and Mr. Biggs made concerning the narrower discovery that we have than under the federal procedure, that it would occur to me that if I was in the posture of defending and was going to be faced with the prospect of representing a defendant in a class action, I would a whole lot rather have the Oregon discovery statute than the federal discovery statute. I had an antitrust case which just settled this week when we were required to produce all our documents in Oregon, Washington, and California going back to 1950. It took two lawyers 3 months just to sort documents. So if I was defending, I'd a whole lot rather have Oregon discovery statute.
I think that's probably true. But the problem comes up with looking at a Rule 23 type of law. You're going to, in order to even manage a class action, unless you have definitive standards as to what is a class and how it's going to be ascertained and what is predominance, you may not be able to determine what your basic issue is and what your class is. Unless you have discovery, and the things you've got yourself into a morass that probably can't be resolved. If you wanted to settle it, you might not be able to, because you wouldn't be able to have the information available that you need. Now, in the federal court, in your discovery situations, the court controls the discovery that's allowed fairly closely. And one of the amendments that is not included that we would one is an answer to a number of federal cases where the plaintiff's been allowed wide discovery and the defendant's been allowed limited discovery. And we think that the defendant, in those contexts, should not be limited in discovery. And as I go through there, there's a very significant problem that has resulted from 23, Rule 23, B3 actions, that relates to why some type of affirmative action by the members of the class, either as a condition preceding or as a condition subsequent to being in the class, is necessary. An affirmative action in way of either opting in, filing a proof of claim that they've been damaged, some type of ascertainable means of knowing where your class is.
All right. What state has the opt-in, opt-out?
Okay, Utah enacted the opt-in provision it's kind of complicated. Those states that have old Rule 23, and some states still do, would have the old opt-in concept, which is probably not workable in the context of a class action unless you bring in a lot of innovative procedures by the judge.
You have the opt-in provision though in derivative suits.
Yes.
But then why wouldn't boilerplating that procedure into this be workable if Old 23 isn't?
Because Old 23 doesn't have some of the guidance that New 23 has in relation to what is a class. Old 23 enactment this year of the Uniform Consumer Sales Practice Act included an opt-in provision. I believe that that's now been signed by the governor. What we're looking at is the opt-in concept that is proposed by the American College of Trial Lawyers in their terminology, which is actually, it's an optional provision. Depending upon the nature of the case, you would have an opt-in. There's class action pending. Unless you include yourself by X date, you will be excluded. Or the court may give them notice that they are in the class unless they request exclusion, and they must submit a proof of claim of injury or damage by a certain date in order to be entitled to participate in the judgment. so that you have greater development there of what the court can do. One of the problems with 23 cases is most of your rulings are all procedural because they haven't been litigated on the merits. And one of the reasons that they haven't been litigated to conclusion on the merits is that the courts have tended to look at the issue in relation to what is the predominant question and sever out the traditional elements of certain causes of action, such as antitrust actions. They will sever out perhaps the question of the designated marketplace or the question of reliance. Now, in the Clayton Act case, in order to be entitled to treble damages, you must prove your specific damages.
All right, so the severance question, the fact that they do sever them is a good reason to have the balance of the federal rules so that you could have that remedy available, which we presently don't under Oregon procedure. On the other hand, the fact that we don't have it and you wouldn't be able to sever them out would lend itself toward the conclusion that if you couldn't sever them and we put this into the Oregon procedure, these cases probably would be litigated to conclusion.
Well, not necessarily. The bill includes a severance provision where you can separate the issues. And what could happen is you might have a determination on the common question. In other words, was there a conspiracy or in a fraud action? We were mentioning fraud, although most fraud actions I would think would be an individual situation. Let's say that you had a common fraud and they severed the traditional issues in fraud element, the cause of action, elements of the cause of action include damages and reliance, specific damages and specific reliance by the plaintiff. You would sever those issues, try the rest of the issues, and then let's say you had a class of 100,000 and each person took an hour to prove his damages and reliance, litigate that question. That's 100,000 hours. Yeah, I don't know what that projects out to in court time, but I believe something around 50 years is one projection that's made. In other words, it would take a long time to litigate that case when you sever those issues. You're putting the defendant in the situation when you allow the predominance of the question that has the commonality to it over those elements that are required to prove the case, you're forcing the defendant in a situation where he's going to be incurring tremendous attorney's fees, and he's got to make an economic decision as to whether it's worthwhile to continue the litigation. And that's, you must get a handle on your class. Now, there are cases where the defendant's records will tell you who the class members are. There are other cases where they won't, and defendant's records are often overrated. But let's get back here a little bit to 23 and how it's worked. And that B1 and B2, which
well,
I think
Kenneth, see, I may interrupt. Really, these amendments go a long way in resolving a lot of the problems you're raising, don't they?
Yes, I haven't. The problems that I'm trying to raise now are ones that are not included in the amendment.
All right, can you submit amendments that will have a little problem that you're going to bring up? Huh?
Good.
You know,
I think that, you know, we've talked with Laird and Charlie at length, you know, about these types of provisions, and I think that we've reached a basic policy problem in it, on those issues. Now,
you could go ahead and work those out with Mr. Kirkpatrick and Mr. Redden and submit them to the committee, it would be very helpful. These committee members have to be back at committee at 7 o'clock, so... we'd like to wind up as soon as we can.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to have the gentleman come up with some suggestions, business. Just supposing that the committee decided that they were going to do something with this bill, and was mentioned about opting in or opting out. I think that I would want to see some kind of an amendment that was workable, and I don't believe it can't be worked so any appreciable damage to a group. Could be rectified. In other words, as I gather, the opponents of this bill say that they can't, since this opting in and opting out, then it isn't convenient, that they're going to kill the bill. Now, I think that you say you can't compromise. I'm not prepared to accept that at this moment. And I think it's a burden's on you, in a sense, to come up with something you can live with that does give the task group some protection.
Okay, if I could quickly make...
Mr. O'Leary, if you'll get something to us, then we'd appreciate it.
Could I raise two more quick points, just in general without being specific?
All right.
Two points that we feel important that are not covered by the amendments are, one, that one of the significant problems for 23 has been the inability of the courts and the different interpretations in determining whether a class action is appropriate. We would like some additional guidelines, which we can suggest, to help the court so there will be a consistency in determination of what the class is and whether a class action is the proper course to follow. The second point is, we think that in a number of these instances, and particularly the cases raised by the legal aid personnel and Mr. Mertens, that a number of those issues may be resolvable through public enforcement situations and the power of the court to convert a B3 action into an equitable proceeding, which avoids the complexity of the notice issues. We think that would be a substantial improvement.
Fine, thank you. If you get that material to us, it would be very helpful.
Can I ask Mr. DeWitter if he would please communicate with Mr. Biggs and ask for the same request that I've made to this gentleman? You understand what I'm talking about?
I'm sorry.
Right. The meeting is adjourned.